This is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian and Carol Holmes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that one funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week as we typically do when we look at the Triangle Business Journal by looking at the inside cover, the biz page. And under the heading of Great Idea comes the article, Raleigh Murals Land in New Exhibit Spots. The murals that popped up across downtown Raleigh after the civil unrest of the summer are now being displayed in a creative way, thanks to a collaboration of multiple groups in the city. Raleigh Arts is partnering with multiple outlets, and the works are being displayed at St. Augustine's and Shaw Universities through December 20th. The works are mounted on shipping containers so that they are easily visible, and the exhibit is being called A Space for Reflection. The idea is for the works to be easily accessible from the street. And under the heading Rising comes the article, Big Price for Legends Sale Shows the Value of Raleigh Real Estate. The recent sale of the site of Legends Nightclub shows just how fast the value of real estate in downtown Raleigh is escalating and how much investors are willing to pour into the city. The club, when it started in 1990, was in a largely rundown warehouse district, disconnected from much of what was happening in downtown. But 30 years later, that area is one of the most explosive parts of the city, which is why Legends owners Tim Bevins and Matt Cozy could command a whopping $4.3 million from CityPlat for the site. By comparison, back in 2003, Greg Hatem paid $1.6 million for 50,000 square feet of buildings downtown that included the Hailey Levine building, which is now the city restaurant. And under the heading of Upgrades Ahead, comes the article, Dated Raleigh Apartments Get a Revamp. If you were young and single in Raleigh in the 1970s, there's a good chance you parked your Volkswagen Beetle at the Lakes Apartments and enjoyed a Schlitz beer by the expansive pool. Raleigh wasn't exactly a rocking kind of town back then, and so the lakes, with a vast array of amenities for the time, were packed on the weekends with guys who hung out on the pool deck and looked like Greg Brady after college. But the cool crowd has traded Beetles for BMWs, and Schlitz has gone the way of Woolworths. But the lakes on a big piece of land near North Ridge Country Club are getting a revamp. Raleigh's Aventon Companies has started construction on a $140 million investment, with 372 luxury apartments. Will be interesting to see the revamp, but the Beatles will be missed. And under the heading of sports, the ACC tournament is back in North Carolina, but impact is likely limited in 2021. The ACC tournament is coming back to Greensboro in 2021, but you can't blame the business community for being less enthusiastic than usual. In most years, hosting the men's tournament is a source of pride and major revenue for the Triad. And this year, the Greensboro Coliseum will host the ACC women's basketball tournament as well. But whether a meaningful amount of fans will be allowed into the arenas remains to be seen. If they don't allow fans, it won't mean much to us, Nancy King Quaintance, the co-owner of Quaintance Weaver Restaurant and Hotels, told Triad Business Journal. Last year, the market had expected a $17.1 million impact before the pandemic forced it to be canceled. And under the heading of jobs comes the article, Chick-fil-A Makes Thunderous Move in Alamance County. Chick-fil-A is making a move into Alamance County, and this time it's bringing some dollars with it. The company is promising the NC Department of Commerce that it will bring 160 jobs, as it builds a major distribution center as part of a $52 million investment. The company had considered Ohio, Indiana, and Texas as well. It could get state incentives worth $1.5 million. And you have to love the Commerce's nickname for the push, Project Thunder. And finally, on the biz page, under the heading of Life of Buddy Holly, comes the article, Next Music Biopic Has a Raleigh Tie. Buddy Holly was only 22 years old when he died in a plane crash outside Clear Lake, Iowa in 1959. His life and death were remembered in the 1971 song American Pie and the 1978 film The Buddy Holly Story. And most Americans know the basic story of the kid with oversized glasses who turbocharged rock and roll. But Rick French, the chairman and CEO of French West Vaughan, is putting a fresh twist on Holly's life after connecting with Holly's widow, Maria Elena Holly, with his service on the Buddy Holly Educational Foundation. She has always been highly protective of and guarded about her husband's image. But French says she felt like there was a lot of the story that hadn't been told. French has moved into the film scene as managing partner of Pre-Productions and already has one film in the works, Survival Saga, Not Without Hope. French had heard stories of the early days of rock through Clarence Collins of Little Anthony and the Imperials, and about what it was like for Holly to play with black artists in the segregated South, including Raleigh. It got me to thinking about how Buddy Holly and these musicians were very much barrier breakers, he says. Patrick Shanahan at Pre wrote the screenplay with Irish actor Rui O'Connor, set to play Holly and sing the songs in a supporting cast that includes Tom Hanks' son, Colin. Filming could begin in the spring, although the pandemic has changed that timeline. The film is expected to include scenes from the recording studio in New Mexico that still has the original Holly equipment and the surf ballroom in Clear Lake where Holly played his last show. He was an artist who just respected other musicians and didn't really see color, French says. Given that, he says, the film has a chance to lean into issues that we're still grappling with today. And next, we turn the page in this week's Triangle Business Journal, and we find the On Healthcare page. And the major article in that, under the heading of Alliance, is entitled Johnston Health to Combine Operations with UNC Health. Johnston Health will be joining its operations with UNC Health at the start of the year, an expansion of an existing partnership that will see UNC invest more than $125 million into the region. On December the 1st, the two systems announced they've finalized a deal to sign a joint operating agreement that will take effect January the 1st, which the systems say will expand their partnership and allow the systems to work more closely together to enhance care, improve outcomes, and increase access for patients in Johnston and Wake counties. Strengthening our collaboration will lead to many benefits for our patients and our hospitals, Ernie Bovio, president of UNC Rex, said in a statement. We can grow better together and add new services and new facilities that will help serve our fast-growing communities. But the deal does more than just bring the two organizations together. According to UNC, the deal also stipulates that the two organizations will review and assess the community's health needs to determine what their priorities should be in coming years, and that UNC Rex will commit $125 million over the next 5 years to expand services and facilities in Johnston County. This is the evolution of a partnership that will benefit both organizations, our co-workers, and our communities, said Tom Williams, president of Johnston Health. Through the years, we've worked together in areas such as radiation, oncology, heart and vascular, gastroenterology, and general surgery, as well as physician coverage that includes hospitalists and specialists such as neonatologists. We've collaborated on the best practices and most recently prepared together for COVID-19. The deal between the health systems started evolving in September of 2019 when the organization signed a letter of intent to sign the joint operating agreement. However, a UNC representative said that because of the massive disruptions brought on by COVID-19, negotiations over the deal were largely put on hold while the systems worked on combating the virus. The deal comes as a further escalation of consolidation of Johnson Health into the UNC health sphere. In 2014, the system formed a joint venture with UNC, including opening a 50-bed community hospital in Clayton in 2015. Johnson Health is based in Smithfield, with a second location in Clayton. Although the system uses much of the UNC branding for its facilities, and UNC says further changes to the system's brand are not expected in the immediate future due to the deal. Also on the healthcare page today comes a couple of interesting articles, one under the heading of NCSU Research. And the article is entitled, Could Chocolate or Green Tea Fight COVID? New research coming out of NC State University says that certain foods, including dark chocolate and green tea, may be inhibitors to the virus that causes COVID-19. A team of plant biologists at NC State has published research in Frontiers in Plant Science detailing how certain chemical compounds may interact with the virus. The team performed lab studies and computer simulations on how the main coronavirus protease reacted to certain chemical compounds, looking at those known for their potent anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties. They found compounds from green tea, two varieties of muscadine grapes, cacao powder, and dark chocolate could bind to portions of the main protease, something that could be a big deal. And under the heading of Seeking FDA Approval, the article Red Hill Expands U.S. Manufacturing. A Raleigh drug maker is expanding manufacturing capacity in the U.S. ahead of an expected emergency use authorization for its treatment for COVID-19. Red Hill Biopharma will partner with two manufacturers for large-scale production of its drug Opaganib. Currently, it is in simultaneous Phase 2-3 trials globally and a Phase 2 study in the U.S. for severe cases of COVID-related pneumonia. Red Hill is looking to build manufacturing capacity for an expected U.S. approval. Dr. Reza Fati, Senior Vice President of R&D, said, together with our recently announced similar partnerships in Europe and Canada, and in light of our rapidly progressing Phase 2-3 Opaganib COVID-19 program, these new U.S. partnerships better place Red Hill to reset potential demand for Opaganib if approved. And finally, from the On Healthcare page, an article under the heading of IPO Planned. And it's entitled, MedTech with UNC Roots to Go Public. A medical technology firm plans to go public as it looks to expand its scale and its roots stretch to UNC Chapel Hill. Boston's 908 Devices has filed paperwork with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission to go public this month on NASDAQ. The company is built around a number of purpose-built, handheld, and desktop mass spectrometry devices for chemical and biomolecular analysis. It was founded in 2012, based around the technology of its scientific founder, Mike Ramsey, a UNC professor of chemistry. Well, next we turn to the finance and tech pages for this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of Social Awareness, we find the article Firm to Offer New Kind of Credit Score. A Raleigh startup is raising nearly $1 million to help you track the impact of every dollar you spend, just in time for the holiday shopping season. Impact Karma has closed on $687,000 in debt, part of a $900,000 raise to help scale the company. Co-founder Jayant Kadikar started the firm last year with his son Kadar Kakari, and the entire round was raised in less than 2 months. The idea came about after Kakari, a UNC Chapel Hill graduate living in Houston, called Kadikar of the challenge of being a conscious consumer. He said, "It's hard for me to do the research every time I'm shopping. There's nothing available out there. We should find a way to do something," Kadikar says. Kadikar, a semi-retired insurance industry veteran and angel investor who has backed co-founder Capital, jumped at the opportunity. The result was Karma Wallet, which analyzes imperfect scores for more than 160,000 brands. He compares it to a credit score, only instead of measuring credit, this impact index is a quantification of the impact you're making on social and environmental causes for every dollar that you spend. The product is being piloted as a corporate benefit for a handful of companies, and corporations paying to offer the score as a benefit is one of multiple potential revenue models, Kadikar says. And under the heading of companies, and also under our finance tech page today, we find the article, Companies Still Covet Triangle. Despite a global pandemic, the economic development pipeline is strong, both in the Triangle and statewide. That's according to top economic developers, speaking even as COVID-19 case numbers continue to rise in the state and across the country. Michael Haley, executive director of Wake County Economic Development, called economic development activity really strong. The county is sitting on 41 active projects with the potential to add up to about $2.3 billion in investment and nearly 13,000 potential jobs. What's really exciting for us is that it's spread across our key industry sectors, he said, pointing to life sciences, technology, and advanced manufacturing. It's a similar story statewide, said Chris Chung, CEO of the state's top economic development recruitment entity, the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina. EDPNC is looking at 180 active projects statewide. It's a pipeline that's potentially worth 39,000 new jobs and nearly $11 billion in capital investment, according to Chung. Of those, 134 are recruitment projects, 46 are classified as expansion deals. The month of November brought in 24 new project proposals, 10 more than the 14 EDPNC reported in November of 2019, Chung said. For the companies we're talking to, I don't get a sense that the pandemic is making major impacts to the plans they're sharing with us, he said. Haley said the consistency in project possibilities his team is seeing year over year is validating. It speaks to the strength of the market and the fundamentals we have here, the overall sense of the trajectory of our market, and our ability as a market to really recover and continue to grow the expansion of our regional economy over time, Haley said. Active projects are just expansions and relocations developers are working to win and are in no way guarantees. But the region has had some major victories in recent months, giving developers cause for optimism. Just last week, Clorox announced plans to bring 158 high-paying jobs to Durham, for example. And Research Triangle Park has been chosen for a huge campus to produce disposable injectors for vaccines, with the potential for 600 jobs. And one more article on the finance tech page this week under the heading of cryptocurrency. Yusko's Fund takes new approach to investing in Bitcoin. Capitol Hill-based Morgan Creek Capital Management is teaming up with digital bank Exos Financial on a fund aimed at luring more institutional investors to Bitcoin. The $7.7 million Morgan Creek Exos Risk Managed Bitcoin Fund LP, disclosed through a recent securities filing, allows investors to dip into Bitcoin, but with less risk than would be involved in owning the currency outright, CEO Mark Yusko explains. Any new thing, people are going to be hesitant to use at first, unless they feel that some of the risks are managed, he says. With a new fund, investors can get direct exposure to Bitcoin, but there are built-in mechanisms to reduce risk, aimed at attracting investors who so far have been wary of digital assets. Asset allocation would be reduced when quantitative signals turn negative. As we talk to institutions over the past 3 years, one of the reasons for not wanting to invest in Bitcoin was it's too volatile, Yusko says. So instead of just buying an index fund where you're exposed to the beta of the market, Morgan Creek and Exos teamed up to create something that had a little alpha to it, he says. Next, we turn to the On Business page of this week's TBJ. And here we find the major article entitled Global Data Deal Impacts Raleigh. Two of the world's largest providers of data to Wall Street are set to combine in a deal with a Raleigh touchpoint. S&P Global Inc. is acquiring London-based IHS Markit, which has an office in downtown Raleigh, in an all-stock deal announced November the 30th. The deal values IHS Markit at $44 billion. IHS Markit came to Raleigh in 2018 after it acquired New York-based financial services firm Apreo for $1.9 billion. Shortly after, Apreo had announced a 250-job expansion in the region. At the time, Apreo had around 350 employees in Wake County. Company officials said the acquisition would not impact hiring plans. IHS Markit is known for its purchasing manager surveys that provide advanced outlooks on economic activity. The company's Raleigh office is at One City Plaza on Fayetteville Street. With the merger, Douglas Peterson, president and CEO of S&P Global, will serve as CEO of the combined company. Lance Ugla, chairman and CEO of IHS Markit, will stay on as a special advisor for 1 year following closing. This transaction is a win for both IHS Markit and S&P Global as we leverage our respective strengths in information, data science, research and benchmarks, Ugla said in a statement. Peterson said, this merger increases scale while rounding out our combined capabilities and accelerates and amplifies our ability to deliver customers the essential intelligence needed to make decisions with conviction. Under the terms of the merger agreement, which has been approved by the boards of both companies, each share of IHS Markit common stock will be exchanged for a fixed ratio of shares of S&P Global common stock. Current S&P Global shareholders will own approximately 67.75% of the combined company on a fully diluted basis, while IHS Markit shareholders will own approximately 32.25%. In 2016, IHS Markit formed through the merger of Colorado-based IHS and London-based Markit. I'm going to change around the order in which I present this week's Triangle Business Journal because the cover page is a collection of 50 companies that have made remarkable progress this year, and I'll have no time to really do a lot of justice to them other than let you know who they are. So rather than doing the cover story next, I'm going to read the executive voice column, which usually follows the cover story. And this week's executive voice belongs to Polly Dunford. In March, Polly Dunford was named president and CEO of IntraHealth International, a global health organization based in Chapel Hill. There was also another development beginning to gain some traction, especially in the U.S., the novel coronavirus. But it's not the first time she's been in a similar situation. Dunford worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development, where she served for almost 20 years, at the earlier stages of another pandemic, HIV. That's when I saw the challenges health workers often faced on the front line, she said. That was before we had access to antiretroviral drugs. Palliative care was the best we could offer in those very early days. By the time Dunford left USAID for IntraHealth, she was a global director for HIV/AIDS. IntraHealth is a 40-year-old nonprofit with about 750 staff members in 33 countries. So, what's the overall mission of IntraHealth? Our mission is all about health workers because without them, health care doesn't happen. Our goal is to improve the performance of health workers and strengthen the systems in which they work so that everyone, everywhere, has the health care they need to thrive. Of course, the pandemic has brought health workers into the public spotlight like never before. They're facing incredible dangers on the front lines of this disease. What led you to your current position? I started off as a Peace Corps volunteer in Côte d'Ivoire. Then I served as a country director of the Near East Foundation in Morocco. I spent most of my career living overseas, including in Cambodia, Haiti, Jordan, Morocco, Mozambique, and Nigeria. I joined IntraHealth because it's an amazing organization with a crucial mission. We're looking to the future and taking on global health's next generation challenges. It's a very exciting time to be in this space, not only because our field is changing, but because the stakes have never been higher. What's the most pressing need for IntraHealth now? Adopting our programs to help countries respond to COVID-19 while keeping our staff safe. We have to make sure health workers have what they need, not only to manage coronavirus, but also to keep everyday essential services up and running. Their communities still need them for delivering babies, providing family planning and HIV services, treating cancer, all the urgent needs that don't stop during a pandemic. We started the COVID-19 Frontline Health Worker Fund for this very reason, to provide health workers with the equipment, training, and support they urgently need now. How has COVID-19 affected the way IntraHealth carries out its mission? I joined IntraHealth in March, right as the pandemic closed down our offices and sent us all to work from home. By now, if these were normal times, I would have visited most of our offices around the world, shaken hands with every one of our country leaders, and visited health facilities with them. But like everyone else right now, we're doing everything remotely. One of my priorities since joining IntraHealth has been to make sure our staff are safe and getting the support they need, whether it's equipment they need for their home office or flexible hours so they can help their kids with remote learning. And our programs have changed how they operate, too. Thanks to our incredibly strong country leaders, our programs have pivoted on a dime, adapting many of our existing systems and digital health technologies to forecast COVID-19 outbreaks and connect clients to care, even when public transport is down or clinics are closed because of the pandemic. In each country, we're adapting to local needs and ever-shifting local restrictions to get the job done. But COVID-19 isn't the only thing this year that's changed how we work. The murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and other black Americans, on top of generations of systemic oppression and trauma in the U.S., spurred us to take a good hard look at ourselves and to act. When will you transition in the triangle from your current base in Washington, D.C.? Right now, all of us at IntraHealth are working from home until it's safe to return to the office. But I hope to move to Chapel Hill within the next couple of years. Until then, because of family considerations, I'll be commuting frequently. What are your goals for IntraHealth? Short term, my goal is to keep our staff safe during this pandemic. Long term, we're developing a strategy to partner with countries and communities to build the health workforce of the future. What do you consider to be your greatest professional triumph? I'm incredibly proud of the role I played in scaling up antiretroviral therapy for people living with HIV over my 15 years with the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. What's the best piece of advice you've received? The best solution to any problem comes in partnership with the people within a community. A health worker named Michelle Maloney Kitts, who is now part of IntraHealth's board of directors, told me this early in my career. I've always remembered it, and it's always been true. What do you do to relax? Be outdoors. I like to run, ski, hike, and swim. Finally, what books are currently on your nightstand? Cast, The Origins of Our Discontent by Isabel Wilkerson. Leadership in Turbulent Times by Doris Kearns Goodwin. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. Now we've finished our executive voice column, and now we turn the page to a series of articles that TBJ has been running for a number of weeks under the heading of The Promise Of. It's a project name based on a historical reference relating to William Sherman's promise of giving 40 acres to slaves after the Civil War. That promise, which came to be known as 40 acres and a mule, never came through as President Andrew Johnson rescinded the order after taking office. And this week's article is entitled The Other Side of Rising Real Estate. The Triangle's reputation as a hot real estate market has existed for decades. But on November the 23rd, when the Urban Land Institute, usually called ULI, released its list of the top 10 overall real estate markets to watch, Raleigh-Durham ranked number one in the country. The only other North Carolina city to make the list, Charlotte, came in at number five. For those who own or develop property in this market, yet another top-tier national ranking bodes well for values and real estate wealth. But for the people who live here but can't afford the cost of housing, neither ownership nor renting in close proximity to their work, the promise of rising real estate prices simply portends increased disenfranchisement. Economic inequality impacts the low-income residents hardest. This is particularly true in triangle neighborhoods that have historically been home to people of color. A virtual conference hosted by ULI Triangle on November the 19th, titled The History of Segregation in the Triangle, Land Use Policies and Beyond, explored the historical context of disenfranchisement as well as current concerns facing Durham, Raleigh, and Chapel Hill. Melissa Mel Norton, an urban planner who spent the last 4 years as project director of the Bull City 150, Reckoning with Durham's Past to Build a More Equitable Future, was one of the presenters. No matter who you are or how much you're making, you're spending more on housing today than you ever have in Durham's history, she said. In the decades following urban renewal, what we saw was a cycle of disinvestment in the central city. Businesses and amenities started to leave. Things like banks and grocery stores left, which led to less maintenance and services, which led to a deterioration in the neighborhood's quality of life, and much fewer restaurants and a lot of vacant properties, she recounted. Move the timeline more recently to the last 15 or 20 years, Norton said, and the big loaded terror became gentrification. Gentrification is the legacy of displacement of people of color, going back to the Native Americans. It's often talked about in value-neutral terms. Is it good or bad? But really, it's a social justice issue. Starting in the early 1990s, the development focus changed, and both the public and private sectors began investing heavily in downtown Durham. Now, I'm hearing statistics that we're attracting 20 people a day to Durham, Norton said, and this creates a real supply and demand problem in housing. If you looked at the people who moved in between 2012 and 2014, there were 70% more white people moving in than the people living there. The only areas of town increasing in the number of people of color are on the outer edges of the county. In a very short period of time, the processes of gentrification are reordering our community demographics. The downside of living in the hottest real estate market in the country hits home for the poorest residents, even when they are working full-time jobs. Norton estimates that housing prices in Durham County have doubled in the last 10 years, while the minimum wage has not increased. Developing real estate without creating economic inequality is one of the biggest challenges in the Triangle. Bree Eklund, Director of Real Estate at Durham-based Self-Help Credit Union, noted, "As a team, we wrestle with that a lot. Our work typically involves a lot of vacant buildings, so we're trying to bring an opportunity to an area and not displace individuals who are already there. What's needed is a way to move the Triangle forward without leaving behind communities of people." Abdul Rashid, the founder and former CEO of the North Carolina Community Development Initiative, described community economic development as a comprehensive market-based approach to fighting poverty. Community economic development will leverage private capital with public resources and community-based knowledge to meet basic needs, stimulate growth, and create assets and wealth for the indigenous population, he said. But there has to be a targeted investment strategy in order to make community economic development work. Another panelist in the ULI Triangle Virtual Conference, Professor Kofi Boone of the NC State University College of Design, focused his presentation on Raleigh, and in particular, the southeast portion of the city and the East Raleigh South Park District. We have a situation where great prosperity and growth has coexisted with systemic inequality along racial lines for a long period of time in our region. He commended the city's comprehensive master plan, noted that it laid out cutting-edge ways to position Raleigh to be a player regionally and nationally in dealing with explosive growth. One of the most important recommendations was densifying the center of the city, which demonstrated a return on investment from an economic standpoint from as little as 4-to-1 to as much as 7-to-1 compared to reinvestment in the suburbs. Regionally, that was an incredible strategy for land use and for real estate development to densify these centers and to tie it together with mass transit and public transportation were visionary. However, what was not visionary were the collateral impacts on people living in the low-income neighborhoods. What did not occur was stabilization of those existing communities, and that's where East Raleigh South Park finds itself, and any other community that's predominantly African-American, and where most people do not own their own property, finds itself, Boone said. The city made a commitment to address some of these problems in the November election when Raleigh voters approved the city's $80 million affordable housing bond, which passed with a landslide vote of more than 70% and supported the bond. Recommended allocation of the bond money would dedicate $16 million to site acquisition for building affordable housing near public transportation. $24 million to provide gap financing, which would be used to help cover the cost of building affordable housing. $28 million to public-private partnerships, a portion of this for nonprofits helping people who are homeless. And $12 million split between down payment assistance for first-time homebuyers and owner-occupied home rehabilitation. There's some creative thinking happening and optimism in the public sector, Boone continues. But there's cause for concern as well, because the conduits that allow community voices to be heard in an organized way and have conversations to build consensus and collaboration with developers is in flux. That's all coming to a head in the Downtown South project. The proposed 160-acre Downtown South mixed-use development has committed that affordable and workforce housing will be included as part of the plan. And they've said discussions are underway with various housing developers to consider different price points. While people are shocked at hearing resistance to what seems like such a positive proposal, it's due to a history where those large plans have brought harm in the past to a contemporary context that would benefit from more focus on inclusion and on allowing communities to be seen and heard, Boone said. Over the last decade, Boone noted there has been renewed interest in the southeastern part of town tied to gentrification, but also tied to the willingness of the city to engage communities in their history and in their public places. Major renovations began in January at the John Chavis Memorial Park. But Boone cautioned, there's a pattern in Raleigh of this kind of interest in the public amenities, but not in the private real estate market. While it comes as no surprise that Durham and Raleigh are grappling with how to balance economic equality during a period of explosive growth, the generalized perception of Chapel Hill is that it's primarily a liberal culture, and by default must be a progressive community when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's not the case, according to Howard Lee, who also participated on the ULI Triangle panel. Lee served as Chapel Hill mayor from 69 to 75, before spending 10 years in the North Carolina Senate between 1990 and 2002, and then being elected chairman of the North Carolina State Board of Education in 2003. While agreeing Chapel Hill is a very liberal, progressive community in some respects, Lee recalled, it ends up being a very conservative community, and change never really came easy. It pretended it wanted to change. There were only 60 units of public housing when he became mayor, with a waiting list of 250 people who needed affordable housing. During his first 2 years in office, the city expanded the affordable housing stock by 150 houses. But like neighboring Durham and Chapel Hill, but like neighboring Durham and Raleigh Chapel Hill, did not accommodate its working class people very well, he said. The police, firefighters, people who serviced the town, could not afford to live there. Housing was out of their reach, so they had to find places to live outside the town and drive in to service the town. Probably they're still finding it difficult to afford to live in Chapel Hill today, Lee said. One of his first projects as mayor was to establish a more livable minimum wage for city employees, such as the sanitation workers and police force. And he thinks there has continued to be progress. But there's still room for improvement, he added. Chapel Hill is not very inviting to people of color, and we still do not have very many people of color choosing to live here. This community needs a broader array of diversity than it has, both socioeconomically and ethnically, as well as youth. According to the U.S. Census Bureau's 2019 estimates, black residents accounted for 9.9% of the population in Chapel Hill, compared with 39.3% of the population in the city of Durham, 29% of the population in Raleigh. I'm concerned about people's access to housing in Chapel Hill, but I'm also concerned that the growth in Chapel Hill is going faster than it should. I'm concerned the road systems can't handle the level of traffic that's occurring, Lee noted. Another thing people need to keep in mind is including greenways and walking trails as a part of any plans within communities. At the conclusion of the virtual ULI Triangle event, the panelists were asked how Triangle developers should think about growing the area while maintaining equity. Lee answered, an equity lens for me is making sure developers know that while they are enjoying the opportunity to develop, there's also the need for a community response and helping to provide for those who are less fortunate. Now we turn to news from around the state. And there are a couple of articles on this page, so let's take a quick look. Under the heading of Tough Year comes the article, Carowinds Looking Ahead to 2021. Carowinds General Manager Pat Jones has finally welcomed guests back to her amusement park. Granted, it's for an abbreviated run and at reduced capacity after a roller coaster of a season. Carowinds launched a new event in November called Taste of the Season after COVID-19 kept its gates closed through much of 2020. That outdoor food festival dishes up sweets and savory items amid holiday decor, seasonal shows, and even a few rides. For Jones, it's a chance to show that Carowinds can operate safely in this new world and entertain people at the same time. She spent much of 2020 planning for opening days that never happened, creating safety protocols, and making sure Carowinds would be in tip-top shape when guests return. The 400-acre amusement park straddles the North Carolina-South Carolina state line just south of Charlotte. With some 2 million visitors in a typical year, Carowinds among the region's biggest tourist attractions. It's owned by Cedar Fold Entertainment Company of Sandusky, Ohio. It's time for 2020 to pass, and let's get on to the next thing. Let's get on to whatever the future brings. We're looking forward to a very, very active and pleasant spring, she says. Jones says the biggest impact of being closed was disappointed fans. When you're staying at home and you've got everyone in your household in the same place for a long time, without a lot of entertainment options other than television and computers, when we couldn't open, our guests were definitely disappointed, she says. The other fallout is we typically employ 4,000 associates in any one year. To not be able to have what I would say is an excellent team back here at the park on a consistent basis, that has a profound impact. There's an economic impact for those 4,000 associates not working. The entertainment and leisure business has been hit extremely hard because we're in the people business. Those associates, unfortunately, bear a good bit of the brunt of not being able to operate. Jones notes the park and company took a financial hit, but she says the company was in a very good position. They made some very good decisions on following the guidance of our authorities, but also doing the right thing for a lot of our associates, making sure that they were continually employed, at least our full-time folks, she says. We supported our employees. The impact is huge, but again, I think the company was built and did enough planning to support our associates that, in the long run, it was an investment in the future. And now the other article on this around the state page is under the heading of aerospace. And the article is entitled Triad Firm Double Space Near Airport and Plans New Jobs. Greensboro-based aerospace company Latitude Aero has doubled its space near Piedmont Triad International Airport with plans to create 15 to 20 new jobs. The company expects the new facility will become fully operational in mid-December with the addition of European Union Aviation Safety Agency certification. The new 100,000-square-foot facility is at Air Park North. The increased storage and manufacturing space will make room for additions, including a machine shop for original equipment manufacturing and a studio for custom seat refurbishment. Our new headquarters will create fresh revenue and labor here in the area, says Kelvin Boyette, Latitude Area President and CEO. By operating a facility roughly double the size of our current operation, we're now able to take on larger projects, run production simultaneously, and provide new capabilities to our clients. Latitude Aero is an aircraft seating overhaul provider that specializes in the integration of in-flight entertainment and in-seat power. And a short article before we close here on staffing, entitled Raleigh Workers See Higher Burnout Than National Averages. More than 2 in 5 Raleigh workers report a heightened level of burnout compared to last year, according to a study by staffing firm Robert Half. On top of that, 55% of local workers feel underpaid. 40% plan to look for another job. Joining Raleigh among the top three for highest burnout are Indianapolis and Dallas, reporting 46 and 43% respectively. Nationally, 34% of workers feel more burned out, and nearly a third plan to look for a new job in the future. On average, 21% of workers reported less burnout nationally. In Raleigh, for employees seeking new jobs, 40% said more money would convince them to stay. Currently, 37% feel underpaid nationally. I hope you'll forgive me, but owing to a glitch in recording, I'm going to reread the editor's notebook for today, which is entitled, Congress Should Consider Offering Home Office Deduction for All WFH Warriors. As lawmakers in Washington fight over the size of another coronavirus stimulus plan to address the needs of businesses and individuals, there's a way to offer a boost to every worker in the country: the expansion of the home office deduction qualification. Without going into the details of our country's tax laws, here's the bottom line currently. If workers are getting a W-2 from their employers, they are not eligible to deduct the expenses tied to having an office at home. Only self-employed individuals can deduct these expenses. In fact, the 2017 tax laws took away almost all of the non-reimbursable expenses by employers from an individual's personal tax return. It's time to change that, even if it is for 1 or 2 years. Time and again, we have been told to work from home. Here's an expense for every worker in this country. Almost every worker had to make adjustments to make sure they were doing their jobs without disruption and make the work-from-home process as smooth as possible for their employers. For millions of workers who never had a home office, primarily because most employers do not allow people to work from home full-time, they had to come up with a designated space in their house to do the Teams and Zoom calls, make sure their internet connections were steady, and buy printers and other office supplies. Under the Internal Revenue Service Code, only self-employed individuals can use the deductions as expenses under their Schedule C form. Of the self-employed person can calculate their home office expenses based on $5 per square foot of space dedicated for official duties. At least for 2020, these provisions should be available for every worker directed by their employers to stay at home and told by government officials that working from home is a way to stop the virus from spreading. Currently, school teachers get a $250 deduction from their taxable income when they buy school supplies for their kids. It's a separate line item in the tax form. The home office deduction expense could be something similar. Congress can also look into providing tax refunds to workers forced to work from home. Earlier this year, under the CARES Act passed by Congress, individuals received a one-time $1,200 stimulus check if they qualified for the incentive based on their income. Congress can have a similar mechanism tied to workers getting refundable tax credits based on their 2019 income tax returns. For example, if a worker paid taxes on $50,000 in taxable income, they could receive 3% or $1,500 as a taxable refund for home office expenses. The taxable income can be capped at $100,000 to make sure CFOs and billionaires are not getting the 3% refunds, just like the stimulus check provisions. The bottom line is we have millions of workers who work from home because of no fault of their own and now incur additional costs and inconveniences as part of their daily budgets. They deserve a break, and here's one way to provide some relief. As usual, this week's Editor's Notebook has a guest column. This column is written by Patrick McHugh, who is a research manager at the Budget and Tax Center within the NC Justice Center. His column is entitled, North Carolina Stuck in a Deep Recession. State labor market data recently released show the recovery continued to limp through October at nowhere near the rate needed to help families in the greatest need. While the recession is largely over for most highly paid North Carolinians, low-wage jobs across our state have been devastated. Even before COVID-19 cases shot up over the past several weeks, the recovery had slowed to a snail's pace, particularly for low-income working people who are running out of options to get by. The U.S. Senate needs to get off the sidelines and actually do something meaningful to help North Carolinians who are bearing the brunt of the job losses. Economic challenges facing North Carolina include these three. The recovery has slowed dramatically in recent months. So after recovering over 230,000 jobs in May and June, North Carolina has only added roughly half that number of jobs in the past 4 months combined. All told, over 40% of the jobs lost since the start of the recession have not been recovered. And North Carolina still needs to add more than 265,000 jobs to get back to where we were before COVID-19. Second point, still a historically low share of North Carolinians are working. The headline rate only captures people who are actively looking for work, so it won't reveal the true extent of job and income losses for North Carolina families. Only 55.2% of North Carolinians were working in October, down from over 59% before the COVID-19 outbreak, and far below levels that were common throughout most of the 1990s and 2000s. Third point, recession is over for most highly paid North Carolinians, while still devastating low-income workers. While not captured in the headline unemployment figures, job losses have fallen the hardest on North Carolinians with the least financial cushion. Data through the end of September indicate the recession was effectively over for North Carolinians who are paid over $60,000, while nearly one in five, which pay under $27,000, are still missing. Now, along with this article comes a series of bar graphs entitled COVID-19 Recession Tracker, and it lists data that are pre-COVID-19 and then October 2020. So I'll try to read these in that order, pre-COVID-19 and October 2020. So total employment, North Carolina, 4.6 million versus 4.3 million. Compared to the United States, 152.5 million versus 142.4 million. The unemployment rate in North Carolina, 3.6% before and 6.3% now. Whereas compared to the United States, that was 3.5% pre-COVID, 6.9% now. Share of residents working in North Carolina, pre-COVID, 59%, now 55%. In the United States, that's 61%, and now 57%. Finally, labor force participation rate in the United States, 63%, and now 61.7%. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Angier. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. So long till next time.